"Well, where are we going? Tell us all about it,"
said Oblonsky.
"The plan is this. We are now going as far as Gwozdyevo. On this side of Gwozdyevo there is a good marsh for snipe, and beyond it are splendid snipe marshes, and there are some great snipe there, too. It's too hot now, but we shall get there toward evening. It's 20 versts, and we'll shoot there in the evening. We'll spend the night there, and then tomorrow we shall go to the big marshes."
"And is there nothing by the way?"
"There is, but it would delay us, and besides, it's hot. There are two nice little places, but we should hardly find anything there." Levin himself felt inclined to stop at those little places, but as they were near home, they were always within his reach, and they were small, so that there was not room enough for three persons to shoot there. So he stretched a point and said they would hardly find anything there. When they came to a small marsh, he wished to drive past it, but Oblonsky, with the practiced eye of a sportsman, noticed the marshy place from the road.
"Oughtn't we to go there?"
he asked, pointing to the marsh.
"Levin, do let us. How delightful,"
begged Vasenka Veslovsky, and Levin could not but agree. Scarcely had they stopped before the dogs flew toward the marsh, racing one another.
"Krak! Laska!"
The dogs returned. "There is not room for three. I'll wait here," said Levin, hoping they would find nothing but the peewits which the dogs had raised, and which, swaying as they flew, cried plaintively above the marsh.
"No, come along, Levin, let's go together," said Veslovsky.
"Really, there's not room."
"Back, Laska! Laska!"
"You don't want two dogs." Levin remained with the trap, and looked enviously at the sportsman. They went over the whole marsh, but there was nothing there except waterfowl and some peewits, one of which Veslovsky killed.
"There, you see, I was not grudging you the marsh," said Levin. "It only meant losing time." "No, it was enjoyable, all the same. You saw," said Vasenka Veslovsky, climbing awkwardly into the cart with his gun and the peewit. "How well I got this one, didn't I? Well, shall we soon get to the real place?"
Suddenly, the horses started. Levin knocked his head against the barrel of someone's gun, and there was a report. Actually, the report came first, but to Levin it seemed the other way about. What had happened was that Vasenka Veslovsky, when uncocking his gun, had pulled one trigger while uncocking the other side. The charge went into the ground without hurting anyone. Oblonsky shook his head and laughed reproachfully at Veslovsky. But Levin had no heart to admonish him. For one thing, because any reproach from him would appear to be provoked by the danger he had escaped and by the bump which had risen on his head, and also because Veslovsky was at first so naively grieved and then laughed so good-naturedly and contagiously at their general perturbation, that Levin could not help joining in the laugh. When they reached the second marsh, which was of considerable size and would take a good deal of time, Levin tried to dissuade them from getting out. But again Veslovsky persuaded him, and again, the marsh being a narrow one, Levin, as a hospitable host, remained with the vehicles. Krak immediately went toward the hummocks. Vasenka Veslovsky was the first to follow the dog. Before Oblonsky had time to approach, a snipe rose. Veslovsky missed it, and it flew over to an unmown meadow. The bird was left to Veslovsky. Krak found it again and pointed. Veslovsky killed the bird and went back to the vehicles.
"Now, you go, and I will remain with the horses," he said.
A sportsman's jealousy was beginning to torment Levin. He handed the reins to Veslovsky and went into the marsh. Laska, who had long been whining plaintively as if complaining of the injustice, rushed straight forward to a likely spot covered with hummocks and known to Levin, where Krak had not yet been.
"Why don't you stop her?" shouted Oblonsky.
"She won't disturb them," answered Levin, pleased with his dog and hurrying after her. Laska became more and more intent on her pursuit the nearer she got to the hummocks. A small marsh bird only diverted her attention for an instant. She described a circle in front of the hummocks and began another, but suddenly shuddered and stopped dead.
"Come along, Steva!"
Levin shouted, feeling his heart beat more rapidly. And suddenly, as if some bar had been withdrawn from his strained sense of hearing, he lost the faculty of measuring distance and was struck by sounds which reached him clearly but without any order. He heard Oblonsky's steps and took them for the distant tramp of horses. He heard the crumbling of a bit of hummock on which he stepped and which broke off, pulling out the grass by the roots, and he took it for the noise of a snipe on the wing. Behind him he heard, too, a sound of splashing for which he could not account. Picking his way, he approached the dog.
"Seize it!"
It was not a great snipe, but a snipe that rose before the dog. Levin raised his gun, but just as he was taking aim, the splashing sounded louder and nearer, mingled with Veslovsky's voice shouting strangely and loudly. Levin knew he was aiming behind the snipe, but fired nevertheless. After making sure he had missed, he turned and saw that the trap and horses were no longer on the road, but in the marsh. Veslovsky, wishing to watch the shooting, had driven into the marsh where the horses had stuck fast. "What the devil brings him here?" muttered Levin to himself, turning back to the vehicle. "Why did you leave the road?" he asked dryly, and calling the coachman, set to work to get the horses out. Levin was vexed that he had been put off his shot, and that his horses had been led into the bog, and especially that neither Oblonsky nor Veslovsky, neither of whom knew anything about harness, helped him and the coachman to unharness the horses and get them out of the bog. Without a word of reply to Vasenka, who was assuring him that it was quite dry there, Levin worked silently with the coachman to disengage the horses. But when heated with the work and seeing Veslovsky pulling at the splashboard so strenuously and zealously that he actually wrenched it off, Levin reproached himself with being influenced by his sentiments of the previous day and with treating Veslovsky too coldly, and he tried to efface his unfriendliness by particular courtesy. When everything was in order and the vehicles had been brought back to the road, Levin gave orders for lunch to be served.
"Bon appétit, bonne conscience. Ce poulet va tomber jusqu'au fond de mes bottes," remarked Vasenka, who had brightened up again, repeating a French saying while he finished a second chicken. "Now our misfortunes are ended, and all will be well. But for my sin, I must sit on the box. Don't you think so, eh? No, I am automaton. Wait and see how I will drive you," he said, keeping hold of the reins in reply to Levin, who wanted him to let the coachman drive. "No, I must expiate my sin, and besides, it's delightful on the box." And he was off. Levin was rather afraid Veslovsky would tire out the horses, especially the roan on the left, whom he did not know how to hold in. But he could not resist Veslovsky's high spirits, the songs he sang all the way while sitting on the box, the stories he told, and his representation of the English way of driving four in hand. And after lunch, they were all in the best of spirits when they reached the Gvozdyevo marsh.
Chapter 10. Veslovsky drove so fast that they arrived at the marsh too soon, while it was still hot. When they got to the real marsh, the object of their journey, Levin involuntarily wished to rid himself of Vasenka and go about unhindered. Oblonsky evidently wanted the same thing, and on his face Levin noticed the preoccupation which every true sportsman feels before the shooting begins, and also a little good-natured cunning characteristic of him.
"Well, what shall we do? It's a splendid marsh, and I see there are hawks, too," said Oblonsky, pointing at two large birds circling above the sedges. "Where there are hawks, there's sure to be game." "Well then, gentlemen," said Levin, with a somewhat gloomy expression, pulling up his boots and examining his percussion caps. "You see that sedge?" He pointed to a dark green little island in an enormous half-mown wet meadow stretching along the right bank of the river. "The marsh begins here, just in front of us. You can see where it is greener. From there it goes to the right, where those horses are. There are hummocks and great snipe. And it goes round that sedge to the alder grove and down to the mill. Look, just there by that little bay. That's the best place. I once shot 17 grouse there. We will separate, going different ways with the two dogs, and we'll meet again by the mill."
"Well then, who goes to the left and who to the right?" asked Oblonsky. "The space on the right is broader, so you two go there together, and I will keep to the left.
he added with affected indifference.
"Good, we'll make the best bag,"
chimed in Vasenka. Levin could not avoid agreeing, and they separated. They had hardly entered the marsh when both dogs began searching together, and started off toward a rusty-looking spot in the marsh. Levin knew Laska's method of search, careful and dubious. He knew it, and expected to see a flight of snipe.
"Veslovsky, walk beside me. Beside me," he whispered with bated breath to his comrade,
who was splashing in the water behind him, and the direction of whose gun, after the accidental shot by the Kolpensky marsh, involuntarily interested Levin.
"No, I don't want to hamper you. Don't trouble about me."
But Levin recollected Kitty's parting words, "Mind and don't shoot one another." Nearer and nearer came the dogs, keeping out of each other's way, and each following its scent. The expectation of finding snipe was so strong that the smacking sound of his heel as he drew it out of the rusty mud sounded to Levin like the cry of a bird, and he grasped the butt end of his gun firmly.
"Bang! Bang!"
he heard just above his ear. Vasenka had fired into a flight of ducks that were circling above the marsh, far out of range, and were at that moment flying straight toward the sportsman. Levin had barely time to turn before he heard the cry of a snipe, then another, and a third, and about eight more rose, one after the other. Oblonsky got one just as it was preparing to begin its zigzag flight, and the bird fell like a small lump into the bog. Oblonsky quietly aimed at another, which was flying low towards the sedges, and at the moment of the report that one too fell, and it could be seen jumping up among the cut sedges, fluttering with one white-edged, uninjured wing. Levin was not so lucky. He fired at the first snipe, too near, and missed. He followed it with his gun when it had already risen, but at that instant another rose just at his feet and diverted his attention, and he missed again. While they were reloading, another bird rose, and Veslovsky, who had finished reloading, fired two charges of small shot over the water. Oblonsky picked up his two snipe and looked with sparkling eyes at Levin.
"Well, now, let's part," he said,
and limping with his left foot and holding his gun ready, he whistled to his dog and went off in one direction. Levin and Veslovsky went in the other. Levin, if his first shots were unsuccessful, always became excited and annoyed and shot badly all the rest of the day. So it was this time. There were a great many snipe. They kept rising before the dogs and at the very feet of the sportsman, and Levin might have recovered himself. But the oftener he fired, the more he disgraced himself before Veslovsky, who was puffing away merrily, in and out of range, never killing anything, but not in the least abashed thereby. Levin hurried, grew impatient, and became more and more flurried, until at last he fired almost without hope of killing anything. Even Laska seemed to feel this. Her search became more and more indolent, and she looked round at the sportsman as if in perplexity and with reproach. Shot followed shot. Powder smoke enveloped the sportsman, but in the large, roomy net of the game bag were only three light little birds, and even of these one had been shot by Veslovsky and another belonged to them both. Meanwhile, from the opposite side of the marsh came not frequent, but, as it seemed to Levin, significant reports from Oblonsky's gun, followed almost every time by a cry to the dog.
"Krak! Krak! Fetch it!"
That excited Levin still more. The snipe unceasingly circled above the sedges. The cry near the ground and sound in the air came incessantly from every side. The snipe that had risen previously and had been flying about descended in front of the sportsman. Not two, but dozens of hawks now soared above the marsh. Having traversed more than half the marsh, Levin and Veslovsky came to a spot where the peasant's meadowland was divided into long strips, the ends abutting on the sedge, and separated by narrow lines where the grass had been trodden down or cut. Half of those strips were already mown. Though there was little hope of finding as many birds in the unmown strips as on the mown part, Levin, having promised Oblonsky to meet him, went with his companion farther on over the mown and unmown strips.
"Hello, you sportsman!"
shouted one of several peasants who were sitting beside a cart from which the horses had been taken out.
"Come and have something with us. A drink of vodka."
Levin turned round.
"Come along. Never mind,"
shouted a merry, bearded, red-faced peasant, showing a row of white teeth and holding aloft a greenish vodka bottle that glittered in the sunshine.
"Qu'est-ce qu'il dit?" asked Veslovsky.
"They are calling us to drink vodka. I expect they have been dividing the meadow."
"I should go and have a drink," said Levin, not quite disinterestedly, hoping that the vodka would tempt Veslovsky and lure him away.
"Why are they offering it?"
"Oh, they're only making merry. Really, you should go to them. It will interest you."
"Allons, c'est curieux."
"Go along. Go, you'll find the way to the mill," cried Levin.
And on looking round, was pleased to see Veslovsky making his way out of the marsh toward the peasants, stooping and stumbling with his weary feet and holding his gun at arm's length.
"You come too,"
shouted a peasant to Levin.
"Come, have a bite of pie."
Levin badly wanted a drink of vodka and a bit of bread. He felt faint and could hardly drag his staggering legs out of the bog, and for an instant he was in doubt. But the dog pointed. His weariness vanished. At once he went easily through the marsh toward the dog. Just at his feet rose a snipe. He fired and killed it. The dog continued pointing.
"Fetch it!"
Another bird rose before the dog. Levin fired, but that day he had no luck. He missed, and when he went to look for the bird he had killed, he could not find it. He tramped all over the sedge, but Laska was incredulous of his having killed anything, and when he sent her to look for it, she only made a pretense and did not really search. Even without Vasenka, whom he had blamed for his ill luck, things went no better. Here, too, were plenty of birds, but Levin missed one after another. The slanting rays of the sun were still hot. His clothes were wet through with perspiration and stuck to his body. His left boot, full of water, was heavy and made a smacking sound. Down his face, grimy with powder, ran drops of sweat. A bitter taste was in his mouth, the smell of powder and rust was in his nose, and the perpetual cry of the snipe was in his ears. He could not touch the barrels of his gun, they were so hot. His heart thumped with short, quick beats. His hands trembled with excitement, and his tired feet stumbled as he dragged them over the hummocks and through the bog. But still he went on and shot. At last, after a disgraceful miss, he threw his gun and hat on the ground.
"No, I must pull myself together," he thought,
picked up his gun and hat, called Laska to heel, and got out of the marsh. When he reached a dry place, he sat down on a hummock, took off his boot and emptied it, then went back to the marsh, drank a little of the rusty water, wetted the heated barrels, and bathed his face and hands. Feeling refreshed, he returned to the spot where a snipe had settled, firmly resolved not to get flurried. He tried to keep calm, but the same thing happened again. His finger pulled the trigger before he had taken aim. Things went from bad to worse. He had only 5 birds in his bag when he came out of the marsh by the alder grove where he was to meet Oblonsky. Before he saw him, he saw his dog. Crack, quite black with smelly marsh slime, sprang out from beneath the upturned root of an alder with the air of a conqueror and sniffed at Laska. Behind Crack, in the shade of the alders, appeared Oblonsky's stately figure. He came toward Levin, red and perspiring, with his shirt unbuttoned, still limping as before.
"Well, you have been firing a good deal,"
he said with a merry smile.
"And you?"
asked Levin. But there was no need to ask, for he already saw the full bag.
"Oh, not bad."
He had 14 birds.
"A famous marsh! I expect Veslovsky was in your way. 1 dog for 2 people is inconvenient,"
said Oblonsky, to soften his triumph. Chapter 11. When Lievin and Oblonsky reached the peasant's hut where Lievin used to put up, Veslovsky was there before him. He sat in the middle of the room, holding with both hands to a bench from which a soldier, a brother of the mistress of the house, was tugging him by his slime-covered boots, and he was laughing with his infectiously merry laugh.
"I have only just got here. Ils ont été charmants. Fancy! They fed me and gave me drink. What bread! Wonderful! Délicieux! And the vodka never tasted better. And they positively would not take any money and kept on saying, 'No offence,' or something of that sort.
Why should they take money? They were entertaining you, you see. Do they keep vodka for sale?"
said the soldier, who had at last succeeded in dragging off one wet boot together with a blackened stocking. Despite the dirtiness of the hut, soiled by the sportsman's boots, the dirty dogs that were licking themselves there, and despite the smell of bog and of powder and the absence of knives and forks, the sportsman drank tea and ate supper with a relish known only when one is out shooting. Washed and clean, they betook themselves to a hay barn that had been swept out, and where the coachman had made up beds for the gentlemen. Though it was already dusk, none of the sportsmen wanted to sleep. After fluctuating between recollections and stories of the shooting, of dogs and of other shooting parties, the talk reached a theme that interested all three. Apropos of Vasenka's repeated expressions of delight at the charm of the arrangements for the night, of the scent of hay, and of a broken cart, which he thought was broken because its four wheels had been removed, of the good nature of the peasants who had treated him to vodka, and of the dogs which lay each at its master's feet, Oblonsky told them about the delights of a shooting party with Malthus at which he had been last summer. Malthus was a well-known railway magnate. Oblonsky spoke of the marshes which Malthus had leased in the province of Tver, of how they were preserved, of the vehicles, dog-carts, in which the sportsmen were driven thither, and of the marquee that was set up for lunch beside the marsh. "I don't understand you," said Lievin, rising on his heap of hay. "How is it that those people don't disgust you? I understand that lunch with good claret is very nice. But is it possible that that very luxury does not disgust you? All those people, like the holders of our drink monopolies formerly, get their money in ways that earn contempt. They disregard that contempt, and afterwards, by means of what they have dishonestly earned, they buy off that contempt."
"Perfectly true," chimed in Vasenka Veslovsky. "Perfectly true. Of course, Oblonsky does it out of bonhomie, and then others say, 'Well, if Oblonsky goes there—'
"Not at all."
Lievin could hear that Oblonsky said this with a smile.
"I simply don't consider him more dishonest than any of the rich merchants or noblemen. They have all alike made money by work and intelligence."
"Yes, but what work? Is it work to get a concession and resell it?
Of course it is work. Work in this sense. That if it were not for him and others like him, there would be no railways."
"But it is not work such as that of a peasant or a savant."
"Granted. But it is work in the sense that his activity yields results. Railways.
But then you consider railways useless."
"That's quite another question. I am prepared to admit that they are useful. But every acquisition out of proportion to the toil contributed is dishonourable."
"But who is to decide the proportion?"
"What is dishonourable is the acquisition by wrong means, by cunning," said Lievin, conscious that he could not clearly define the boundary between honesty and dishonesty,
"such as the profits made by banks, the acquisition of enormous wealth without work, just as in the days of the drink monopolists. Only the form has changed. Le roi est mort, vive le roi. Hardly were the monopolies stopped before railways and banks appeared, other means of acquiring wealth without work."
"Well, all you say may be quite correct and ingenious."
"Down, crack!"
exclaimed Oblonsky to the dog that was scratching itself and turning round in the hay. He was obviously convinced of the truth of his own view, and was therefore calm and deliberate.
"But you have not defined the boundary between honest and dishonest work. I receive a bigger salary than my head clerk, though he knows the work better than I do. Is that dishonest?"
"I don't know."
"Well, then, I'll tell you.
that you receive for your work on the estate a profit, let's say, of 5,000 roubles, while our peasant host, work as he may, cannot get more than 50, is just as dishonest as my receiving more than my head clerk, or Malthus getting more than a railway mechanic. In fact, I notice a quite unjustifiable hostility on the part of the public toward these men, and it seems to me that it is envy.
Oh, no, that's not fair, said Veslovsky. It can't be envy,
and there is something not clean in their business.
No, allow me, Levin broke in.
You say it is unjust for me to receive 5,000 while the peasant gets only 50 roubles.
That's true.
It is an injustice, and I feel it, but
yes, indeed, why do we eat and drink, go shooting, and do no work while he is always, always working?
Said Vasenka Veslovsky, evidently for the first time in his life thinking of this, and therefore speaking quite genuinely.
Yes, you feel it, but you won't give him your estate, said Oblonsky, purposely provoking Levin.
A covert hostility had sprung up between the two brothers-in-law of late, as if being married to two sisters had evoked a sense of rivalry as to which of them would make the best of his life, and now this hostility found expression in the personal tone the discussion was assuming.
"I don't give it away, because nobody demands that of me, and if I wanted to, I could not do it," replied Levin. "Besides, there is no one to give it to.
Give it to this peasant. He won't refuse."
"Yes, but how should I set about it?
Should I go with him and execute a conveyance?"
"I don't know.
But if you are convinced that you have no right..."
I'm not at all convinced. On the contrary, I feel that I have no right to give it away, that I have duties toward the land and toward my family.
Now, allow me. If you consider such inequality unjust, why don't you act accordingly?"
"But I do act so, only in a negative sense, in the sense that I will not seek to increase the inequality that exists between my position and theirs."
"Oh, pardon me, that is a paradox." "Yes, that is a sophistical explanation," put in Veslovsky. "Oh, our host," he said, addressing a peasant who had opened the creaking barn doors and was entering. "So, you're not asleep yet?"
"No, how can I sleep? I thought you gentlemen were asleep, but then I heard you chatting. I want to get a crook here."
"She won't bite?"
he asked, cautiously stepping with bare feet.
"And where are you going to sleep?"
"We are going to pasture the horses tonight."
"Oh, what a night!"
cried Veslovsky, gazing at the corner of the hut and the carts visible in the faint afterglow through the now open barn doors, as in a frame.
"Just listen. It's women's voices singing, and not at all badly. Who is that singing, mine host?"
"Why, the maidservants close by."
"Come, let's go for a walk. We shan't sleep, you know. Oblonsky, come along."
"If only one could go without getting up," said Oblonsky, stretching himself.
"It's delightful to lie still."
"Well, then, I'll go alone," said Veslovsky, rising quickly and putting on his boots. "Goodbye, gentlemen. If it's jolly, I will call you. You have treated me to game, and I won't forget you."
"Isn't he a fine fellow?" said Oblonsky, when Veslovsky had gone out and the peasant had shut the doors after him.
"Yes, fine,"
answered Levin, continuing to think of the question they had been discussing.
It seemed to him that he had expressed his thoughts and feelings as clearly as he could, yet both the others, sincere and not stupid men, had agreed that he was comforting himself with sophistry. This perturbed him.
"That's what it is, my friend. One of two things. Either you confess that the existing order of society is just and then uphold your rights, or else own that you are enjoying unfair privileges, as I do, and take them with pleasure."
"No. If it were unjust, you could not use such advantages with pleasure. At any rate, I could not. The chief thing for me is not to feel guilty."
"I say,
"'Hadn't we really better go?' put in Oblonsky, evidently weary of the mental strain. "'We can't go to sleep, you know. Come on, let's go.' Lievin did not reply. The words he had used when he said he was acting justly in a negative sense occupied his mind. "'Is it possible that one can act justly only in a negative sense?' he asked himself.
"'Hasn't the fresh hay a strong scent?' remarked Oblonsky, sitting up.
"'Nothing will make me sleep. Vasenka is up to something out there. Don't you hear the laughter and his voice?
Shan't we go, too? Let's!'
"'No, I'm not going,' answered Lievin.
"'Maybe you're stopping here on principle,' said Oblonsky, smiling, as he searched in the dark for his cap.
"'No, not on principle, but why should I go?'
"'Do you know, you will bring trouble on yourself,' said Oblonsky, having found his cap and getting up.
"'Why?'
"'Don't I see how you have placed yourself with your wife? "'I heard you discussing as a question of first-rate importance "'whether you should go away shooting for 2 days or not. "'Well, that's all very well for an idyll, but it can't last a lifetime. "'A man should be independent. "'He has his own masculine interests. "'A man must be manly.'
said Oblonsky, opening the door. "'Is that to say he should court the maidservants?' asked Lievin.
"'Why not, if it's amusing?'
"'Ça ne tire pas à conséquence.
"'My wife won't be the worse for it, and I shall have a spree. "'The important part is to guard the sanctity of the home. "'Nothing of that kind at home. "'But you needn't tie your hands.'
"'Perhaps,' said Lievin, dryly, and turned on his side.
"'Tomorrow one should start early, and I shall wake no one but shall start at daybreak.
"'Monsieur, venez vite!'
came the voice of Veslovsky, who had come back.
"'Charmante! It's my discovery! Charmante! A perfect Gretchen, and I have already made her acquaintance. Really, very pretty!'
he said, in such an approving way as if she had been made pretty specially for him, and he was satisfied with the maker. Lievin pretended to be asleep, but Oblonsky, having put on his slippers and lit a cigar, left the barn, and their voices soon died away. Lievin could not fall asleep for a long time. He heard his horses chewing hay, then how the master and his eldest son got ready and rode away for the night to pasture their horses. Then how the soldier settled down to sleep on the other side of the barn with his nephew, their host's little son. He heard the boy in his treble voice imparting to his uncle his impressions of the dogs, which seemed to him terrible and enormous. Then how the boy asked what those dogs were going to catch, and he heard how the soldier replied in a hoarse and sleepy voice that the sportsmen would go next day to the marshes and fire guns, adding, to stop the questioning,
"'Sleep, Vaska, sleep, or else look out!'
Soon the soldier himself began to snore, and all was still, except for the neighing of the horses and the cry of snipe. "'Can it be only done in a negative sense?' Lievin repeated to himself. "'Well, what then? It's not my fault.' And he began to think of the coming day. "'Tomorrow I will start early in the morning and make up my mind not to get excited. "'There are quantities of snipe, and great snipe, too. "'And when I come back, there will be a note from Kitty. "'Well, perhaps Stiva is right. "'I am not manly with her. I have grown effeminate.
"'Well, what's to be done?'
Again, the negative answer. Through his sleep he heard laughter and Veslovsky's and Oblonsky's merry talk. He opened his eyes for an instant. They were standing chatting in the open doorway, brightly lit up by the moon which had now risen. Oblonsky was saying something about the freshness of a girl, comparing her to a fresh kernel just taken from its shell, and Veslovsky was laughing his merry, infectious laugh, and repeating something that had probably been told him by a peasant.
"'You'd better strive for a wife of your own!'
"'Gentlemen, tomorrow
at dawn, Lievin mumbled drowsily and fell asleep.
Chapter 12. Waking at early dawn, Lievin tried to rouse his companions. Vasenka, lying prone with one stockinged leg outstretched, was sleeping so soundly that it was impossible to get any answer out of him. Oblonsky, half asleep, refused to budge so early. Even Laska, sleeping curled into a ring on the corner of the hay heap, got up reluctantly and lazily stretched and adjusted first one hind leg and then the other. Having put on his boots, taken his gun, and carefully opened the creaking barn doors, Lievin went out into the street. The coachmen were asleep beside the vehicles. The horses were drowsing. Only one of them was lazily eating oats, scattering them over the edge of the trough. The outside world was still grey.
"Why have you risen so early, my dear?"
said his aged hostess, who came out of her hut, addressing him cordially as a good old acquaintance.
"Why, I'm off shooting, Granny. Can I get to the marsh this way?"
"Straight along at the back of the huts, past our threshing floors, my dear, and then through the hemp field. There's a path."
Carefully stepping with her bare, sunburnt feet, the old woman showed him the way and lifted for him one of the bars enclosing the threshing floor.
"Go straight on and you'll step right into the marsh. Our lads took the horses that way last night."
Laska ran ahead gaily along the footpath, and Lievin followed at a brisk pace, continually glancing at the sky. He did not wish the sun to rise before he reached the marsh, but the sun did not tarry. The moon, which was still giving light when first he went out, now shone only like quicksilver. The streak of dawn, previously so noticeable, now had to be looked for. What had been vague spots on the distant field were now clearly visible. They were shocks of rye. Still invisible in the absence of the sun, the dew on the tall, scented hemp from which the male plants had already been weeded out wetted Lievin's legs and his blouse to above his belt. In the translucent stillness of the morning, the slightest sounds were audible. A bee flew past his ear, whistling like a bullet. He looked close and saw another and a third. They all came from behind the wattle fence of an apiary, and flying across the hemp field, disappeared in the direction of the marsh. The path led him straight to the marsh, which was recognizable by the mist rising from it, thicker at one spot and thinner at another, so that the sedge and willow bushes looked like islets swaying in the mist. At the edge of the marsh, the peasant boys and men who had pastured their horses in the night lay, covered with their coats, having fallen asleep at daybreak. Not far from them, three hobbled horses were moving about. One of them clattered its shackles. Laska walked beside her master, seeking permission to run forward and looking around. When he had passed the sleeping peasants and reached the first wet place, Lievin examined his percussion caps and allowed Laska to go. One of the horses, a well-fed three-year-old chestnut, on seeing the dog, started, lifted his tail, and snorted. The other horses, also alarmed, splashed through the water with their hobbled feet, making a sound of slapping as they drew their hoofs out of the thick, clayey mud, and began floundering their way out of the marsh. Laska paused with a mocking look at the horses and a questioning one at Lievin. He stroked her and whistled as a sign that she might now set off. Joyful and preoccupied, Laska started running across the bog, which swayed beneath her feet. On entering the marsh, Laska at once perceived, mingled with the various familiar smells of roots, marsh, grass and rust, and with the unfamiliar smell of horse dung, the scent of the birds, those strong-smelling birds that excited her most, spreading all over the place. Here and there, among the marsh mosses and docks, that smell was very strong, but it was impossible to decide in which direction it grew stronger or weaker. To find this out, it was necessary to go further away in the direction of the wind. Hardly aware of her legs under her, Laska ran at a strained gallop, which she could cut short at a bound should occasion arise, to the right, away from the morning breeze which blew from the east, and then turned to windward. After inhaling the air with distended nostrils, she knew at once that not their scent only, but they themselves were there, before her, not one only, but many of them. She slackened speed. They were there, but she could not yet determine exactly where. To decide this, she began working round in a circle, when her master's voice disturbed her.
"Laska, here,"
he said, pointing to the other side. She stood still, as if asking him whether it would not be better to continue as she had begun. But he repeated his command in a stern voice, pointing to a group of hummocks covered with water where there could not be anything. She obeyed, pretending to search in order to please him, went over the whole place, and then returned to the first spot, and immediately scented them once more. Now that he was not hindering her, she knew what to do, and without looking where she was stepping, stumbling over hummocks and getting into the water, but surmounting the obstacles with her flexible, strong legs, she began the circle which was to make everything clear. Their scent came to her more and more pungently, more and more distinctly, and all at once it became quite clear to her that one of them was here behind a hummock, 5 steps in front. She stopped, and her whole body grew rigid. The shortness of her legs prevented her seeing anything before her, but from the scent she could tell that it was not 5 paces off. She stood, more and more conscious of its presence and enjoying the anticipation. Her rigid tail was outstretched, only its very tip twitching. Her mouth was slightly open and her ears erect. One of her ears had turned back while she ran. She breathed heavily but cautiously, and yet more cautiously looked toward her master, turning her eyes rather than her head. He, with his familiar face but ever terrible eyes, came stumbling over the hummocks, but unusually slowly, she thought. So it seemed to her, though in reality he was running. Noticing Laska's peculiar manner of searching, as lowering her body almost to the ground, she appeared to be dragging her broad hind paws, he knew that she was pointing at snipe, and while running up to her he prayed inwardly for success, especially with the first bird. Having come close up to her, he looked beyond, and from his height saw with his eyes what she had found with her nose. In the space between the hummocks, at a distance of about a satsun, he could see a snipe. It sat, with turned head, listening. Then, just spreading its wings slightly and folding them again, it vanished round a corner with an awkward, backward jerk.
"Seize it! Seize it!"
shouted Lievin, pushing Laska from behind.
"But I can't go," thought she. "Where should I go to? From here I sent them, but if I go forward I shall not know what I am doing, nor where they are, nor who they are."
But now he pushed her with his knee, saying in an excited whisper,
"Seize it, Laska, seize it!"
"Well, if he wishes it, I will, but I can no longer answer for anything," thought Laska,
and rushed forward at full tilt between the hummocks. She now scented nothing more, but only saw and heard without understanding anything. With lusty cries and a sound of the beating of concave wings so peculiar to the great snipe, a bird rose, and, following the report of the gun, it fell heavily on its white breast 10 paces from the first spot into the wet bog. Another rose behind Lievin without waiting to be disturbed by the dog. By the time Lievin had turned toward it, it had already gone far, but his shot reached it. After flying some 20 feet, the second snipe rose at an acute angle and then, turning round and round like a ball, fell heavily on a dry spot.
"Now things will go right,"
thought Lievin, putting the warm, fat snipe into his bag.
"Eh, Laska dear? Will things go right?"
When, having reloaded, Lievin went on again, the sun, though still invisible because of the clouds, had already risen. The moon had lost all her brilliancy and gleamed like a little cloud in the sky. Not a single star was any longer visible. The marsh grass that had glittered like silver in the dew was now golden. The rusty patches were like amber. The bluish grasses had turned yellowish green. Marsh birds were busy in the dew-bespangled bushes that cast long shadows beside the brook. A hawk had woken up and was sitting on a haycock, turning its head from side to side and looking discontentedly at the marsh. Crows were flying to the fields, and a barefooted boy was already driving the horses toward an old man who had got up from beneath his coat and sat scratching himself. The powder smoke spread like milk over the green grass. A boy ran up to Lievin.
"Uncle, there were ducks here yesterday," he shouted, following Lievin from afar.
And Lievin felt increased pleasure in killing three snipe, one after another, within sight of this little boy, who expressed his approval. Chapter 13. The sportsman saying that if you don't miss your first beast or first bird, your day will be successful, was justified. Tired, hungry, and happy, Lievin returned to his lodging toward 10 o'clock, having tramped some 30 versts and bringing 19 red-fleshed birds beside a duck tied to his girdle, as there was no room for it in his bag. His comrades had wakened long before and had had time to get hungry and have their breakfast.
"Wait a bit, wait a bit, I know there are 19, said Lievin, for a second time counting his snipe and great snipe, which no longer had the important appearance they bore when on the wing, but were twisted, dried up, smeared with congealed blood, and had heads bent to one side. The tale was correct, and Oblonsky's envy gratified Lievin. He was also pleased that on his return he found a messenger had already arrived from Kitty with a note. "I am quite well and happy. If you were uneasy about me, you may be quite at ease now. I have a new bodyguard, Maria Vlasyevna." This was the midwife, a new and important personage in the Lievin's family life. "She has come to see me and finds me perfectly well, and we have got her to stay till your return. All are cheerful and well, so don't hurry, and even stay another day if your sport is good." These two joys, his successful shooting and the news from his wife, were so great that two small unpleasantnesses which occurred after the shooting were easy to disregard. One was that the chestnut side horse, having evidently been overworked the previous day, was off its feed and seemed dull. The coachman said it had been strained.
"It was overdriven yesterday, Konstantin Dmitrich," he said. "Why, it was driven hard for 10 versts.
The other unpleasantness, which for a moment upset his good humour, but about which he afterwards laughed heartily, was that of all the provisions that Kitty had provided so lavishly that it had appeared impossible to eat them up in a week, nothing was left. Returning tired and hungry from his sport, Lievin so vividly anticipated the pies that on approaching his lodging he seemed to smell and taste them, just as Laska scented game, and he immediately ordered Philip to serve them. It turned out that there were no pies, nor even any chicken, left.
"He has an appetite," said Oblonsky, laughing and pointing to Vasenka Veslovsky. "I don't suffer from lack of appetite, but he's quite surprising."
"Well, it can't be helped," said Lievin, looking morosely at Veslovsky. "Well then, bring me some beef, Philip." "The beef has been eaten, and the bone was given to the dogs," answered Philip.
Lievin was so annoyed that he said crossly, "Something might have been left for me," and he felt inclined to cry.
"Well then, draw the birds and stuff them with nettles," said he in a trembling voice to Philip, trying not to look at Veslovsky, "and ask at least for some milk for me."
Later on, when he had satisfied his hunger with the milk, he felt ashamed at having shown annoyance to a stranger, and he began laughing at his hungry irritation. In the evening, they again went out shooting, when Veslovsky also killed some birds, and late at night, they set off home. The drive back was as merry as the drive out had been. Veslovsky now sang, now recalled with relish his adventures with the peasants who entertained him with vodka, and said, "No offence," and now his night exploits with hazelnuts, the maidservant, and the peasant who asked him whether he was married, and learning that he was not, said, "Don't hanker after other men's wives, but above all things strive to get one of your own." These words particularly amused Veslovsky.
"Altogether, I'm awfully pleased with our outing. And you, Levin?"
"I'm very pleased with it, too," said Levin, sincerely. He was glad not only to feel no hostility, such as he had felt at home toward Vasenka Veslovsky, but on the contrary, to feel quite friendly toward him. Chapter 14. Next morning at 10 o'clock, Levin, having made the round of his farm, knocked at the door of Vasenka's room.
"Entrez!"
shouted Veslovsky.
"Excuse me, I have only just finished my ablutions," he said, smiling, as he stood before Levin in his underclothes. "Please, don't mind me."
And Levin sat down by the window.
"Have you slept well?" "Like the dead. What a day it is for shooting."
"What do you drink? Tea or coffee?"
"Neither. Nothing before lunch. I'm really quite ashamed. I expect the ladies are already up. It would be fine to go for a walk now. You must show me your horses."
When they had walked round the garden, visited the stables, and even done some gymnastics together on the parallel bars, Levin returned to the house with his guest and entered the drawing-room with him.
"We had fine sport and so many new impressions," said Veslovsky, approaching Kitty, who sat at the samovar. "What a pity ladies are deprived of that pleasure."
"Well, what of it? He must say something to the mistress of the house," Levin told himself. He again thought he noticed something in the smile and conquering air with which the visitor addressed Kitty. The princess, who sat at the other end of the table with Maria Vlasyevna and Oblonsky, called Levin and began a conversation about moving to Moscow for Kitty's confinement and taking a house there. Just as all the preparations for the wedding had been disagreeable to him, since they detracted by their insignificance from the majesty of what was taking place, so now the preparations for the coming birth, the time of which they were reckoning on their fingers, appeared to him yet more offensive. He always tried not to hear those conversations about the best way of swaddling the future infant, tried to turn away and not see those mysterious, endless knitted binders and three-cornered pieces of linen to which Dolly attached special importance, and all the rest. The birth of a son, he was certain it would be a son, which they promised him, but in which he still could not believe, so extraordinary did it seem, appeared to him on the one hand such an immense and therefore impossible happiness, and on the other such a mysterious event, that this pretended knowledge of what was going to happen and consequent preparations as for something ordinary, something produced by human beings, seemed to him an indignity and a degradation. But the princess did not understand his feelings and attributed his unwillingness to think and speak about it to thoughtlessness and indifference, and therefore gave him no peace. She was now commissioning Oblonsky to see about a house, and called Levin to her.
"I don't know at all, princess. Do as you think best," he said.
"You must decide when you will move."
"I really don't know. I know that millions of children are born without Moscow and without doctors. Then why—"
"Well, if that's—"
"Oh, no, just as Kitty likes."
"But one can't talk to Kitty about it. Why, do you want me to frighten her? You know, only this spring Natalie Golitsyn died because she had a bad doctor."
"I will do whatever you tell me to," he replied morosely. The princess began telling him, but he did not listen to her.
Though this talk with the princess upset him, it was not that, but what he saw by the samovar which made him morose.
"No, this is impossible," he thought,
glancing occasionally at Vasenka, who was leaning toward Kitty and saying something with his handsome smile, and at Kitty, blushing and agitated. There was something impure in Vasenka's attitude, his look and his smile. Levin even saw something impure in Kitty's pose and smile. And again the light faded from his eyes. Again, as on the previous occasion, he suddenly, without the least interval, felt thrown from the height of happiness, peace, and dignity into an abyss of despair, malevolence, and degradation. Again, everyone and everything became revolting to him.
"Well then, Princess, let it be just as you think best," he said, turning away.
"Heavy is the autocrat's crown," said Oblonsky, banteringly, evidently alluding not only to the princess's conversation, but also to the cause of Levin's agitation, which he had observed.
"How late you are today, Dolly!"
They all rose to greet Dolly. Vasenka only rose for a moment, and with the absence of politeness to women which is characteristic of modern young men, barely bowed, and again continued his conversation, laughing at something.
"Masha has worn me out. She slept badly, and is terribly capricious this morning," said Dolly.
The conversation with Kitty, begun by Vasenka, again dealt with Anna, and with the question whether love can rise above social conditions. This conversation was unpleasant to Kitty and upset her, both by the subject itself and by the tone in which it was carried on, but especially because she already knew the effect it would have on her husband. But she was too simple and innocent to know how to stop it, or even how to conceal the superficial pleasure which this young man's evident attentions caused her. She wished to put an end to the conversation, but did not know how. Whatever she did, she knew would be noticed by her husband, and would all be construed into something wrong. And really, when she asked Dolly what was the matter with Masha, and Vasenka, waiting for this uninteresting conversation to finish, gazed indifferently at Dolly, her question seemed to Levin a piece of unnatural and disgusting cunning.
"Well, shall we go to pick mushrooms today?" said Dolly.
"Yes, please, and I will go too," said Kitty, and blushed. She had been going out of politeness to ask Vasenka whether he would go with them, but refrained.
"Where are you going, Kostya?"
she asked her husband with a guilty look as he passed by with resolute steps. This guilty look confirmed all his suspicions.
"The mechanic arrived during my absence, and I've not yet seen him," he answered, without looking at her.
He went downstairs, but had not had time to leave his study before he heard his wife's familiar footsteps following him with imprudent rapidity.
"What is it?" he asked dryly. "We're busy."
"Excuse me," she said, addressing the German mechanic. "I have a few words to say to my husband." The German was about to go out, but Levin said to him,
"Don't trouble." "The train is at 3? Asked the German. "I must not miss it."
Levin did not answer him, but went out with his wife.
"Well, what have you to say to me?" he asked in French. He did not look her in the face, and did not notice that she, in her condition, stood with her whole face twitching, and had a pitiful, crushed appearance.
"I want to tell you that it's impossible to live like this. It's torture," she muttered.
"The servants are there, in the pantry," he said angrily. "Don't make a scene."
"Well then, come here."
They were in a passage, and Kitty wished to enter the next room. But the English governess was there, giving Tanya a lesson.
"Well, come into the garden."
In the garden they came upon a man weeding a path, and without any longer considering that the man saw her tear-stained eyes and his excited face, or that they looked like people running away from some calamity, they went on with rapid feet, feeling that they must speak out and convince each other, must be alone together, and thereby both escape from the torment both were experiencing.
"One can't live like this. It is torture. I suffer and you suffer,"
Why? She asked.